This week on the PhDcast, we're exploring the far future. We're joined by PhD's Worldwide Strategy and Planning Director, Mark Holden, to talk sentience of the internet, future brains and brains, and how we and the internet will evolve to form one happy, sentient, cohesive whole. This is the PhDcast from PhD Australia. Hey, I'm Chris Stevenson, and joining me on a very, very special PhDcast this week, alongside podcast regulars Stu Gurney.
Hello.
Christian.
Hello.
And Jess.
Hello.
Is only the Worldwide Strategy and Planning Director for PhD Galactic, Mark Holden.
Hello, it's wonderful to be here.
How are you doing?
I feel great.
Thank you very much for joining us. And how long have you been in Australia for?
3 years.
Brilliant. And having fun so far?
So far, so good.
Very cool.
Good being here.
Very cool. And we're here, and while you are here, we're going to talk about the far future of media this week. Based on an article you wrote for Campaign Asia a couple of months back, where you explored what would happen in media over the course of the next 40 years. One of the first things you talk about is a deep human underlying and unconscious drive for abundance. What is that unconscious drive for abundance that we as humans have? And why is it so important when you're playing the media or any future prediction game?
Well, the abundance concept was something that we brought to bear in the book 2016 that we published about three, four years ago. And because we wanted to try and come up with some way of understanding what technologies take hold and become successful and those that don't. And the principle behind it was that there is probably some deep need that is consistent with any technology that gets answered. So something at a fundamental level that gets satisfied by any technological development that becomes successful. So if you sort of break it down and you sort of think about the core of any technology, we sort of felt it was allowing us as individuals to be liberated beyond the confines of the three-dimensional world around us. You know, so for example, an aeroplane allows you to move from one part of the world to the other. If you think about
mobile phones
allows you to communicate. So this kind of three-dimensional kind of like, you know, world that we exist within is actually, if you think about, you know, if you do sort of dip into sort of the world of sort of physics, and you get stuck, get lost in the quantum physics theories, which I have done, you realise that at a fundamental level, matter isn't linked, isn't kind of bounded by a three-dimensional construct. It is actually across multi-dimensions. There is no three dimensions only. So at a fundamental level, it feels like it might be that there is a sort of a potential to exist outside of three dimensions. So if that's the case, it might be that that's where evolution is going. So if any technology that ever is successful perhaps liberates us, allows us to be in more than one place or be in places very quickly or have access to information that has hitherto been hard to access, just have it. So if you think about all of these things together, the word that really captures that is this word abundance. So it doesn't mean to be overwhelmed by, because you're in control of it, but to have whatever you want and be wherever you want without any restriction. That, I feel, is probably the underlying driver of all technology. And if it answers that need, it will be successful.
And in terms of technology, in terms of technology right now and the technology that is most driving us towards abundance, then it's probably fair to say that the internet itself is probably the technology right now that is most driving us towards this state. And you talk a lot about how the internet itself is evolving and may actually gain sentience itself towards this state.
If you look at how technology has evolved, and we you know, it's all hierarchical. So you have, you know, you have electricity, you have computer, and then you link the computers together, you then have the internet, and then once the internet's all linked together, you start to notice that we're linked to it as well, and therefore you then switch that in, bring us in through social media. So each level is kind of bringing more sort of, you know, another layer of hierarchy on top of the other. So each one allows the next one to happen. And with social media, so much data, so much sentient data now that's flowing into the internet, that it almost feels like that is the platform for, to which the next level should be built. And the next level is most likely to be artificial intelligence, that the internet will simply internet information will be organized more effectively in, again, hierarchical way, so that it can wake up, which is kind of what Ray Kurzweil, who's the head of engineering for Google, who Time magazine called the natural heir to Edison, and he's very predictive. He uses the law of accelerating returns and Moore's law to predict change very, very accurately. He's now got sort of untold, you know, resource of Google to basically make the internet switch on, wake up. And effectively, you know, so it's, you know, things like, you know, the internet at the moment doesn't understand the relationship between a tree and a table. It doesn't understand that wood from the tree creates a table. It doesn't understand that the relationship between a cup and a table. It doesn't understand you need a table for the cup sits on the table. So that's just a real kind of crude example of how once the... If you imagine internet information being like a massive hangar full of information, imagine we just going in there, it's messy, it's everywhere. Imagine going in and cataloguing and organising internet information so it all starts to become hierarchically structured. At that point then, you can have a sentient artificial intelligence. At the moment, we have a basic form of it, in the likes of Siri and Google Now, but it's kind of, it's manufactured. But at some point, the internet can wake up. He thinks it'll be 2029, that it's quite a specific date, and he's written about it in his book, Singularity Is Now. But at that point, so 15 years from now, the internet literally wakes up, and you can speak to it. And you can see now that even movies, art, is starting to get close to this now. So the classic kind of future movies of kind of spaceships flying down and shooting, and there's starting to be something more accurate movies of the future, like Her, the recent movie that's just come out. And also, what's the other one that's... Transcendence. So these are the sort of movies that you sense are starting to get more accurate about what the future might be like.
Dude, what's really scary for me, like scary, speaking about movies as well, it reminds me of Wall-E, do you know when everyone's really fat and they're in one of those giant bubbly things and everyone's kind of lost all willingness to move around, which scares me in many ways. But the unpredictability thing around that isn't about technology, it's about kind of the human drive. So we're seeing a lot of backlash around privacy in a short term, and backlash around information and how that data can actually come to light. So given those kind of constraints, do you think that end goal is feasible? I mean, get it from just let technology kind of evolve and do its own thing, but the kind of the unquantifiable factor in is how we are going to respond as a society around that. Do you think we would ever allow that to happen, I guess is my question.
It's a really good question. My instinct is that the privacy anxiety is a natural braking system that slows the machine down and probably guides it in the right way. But I don't think it's a handbrake. I think it's just a brake pedal that gets pushed aside. I think there's a momentum that's too great. And I think that there, you know, even just right now, all us in the room, we could come up with a product that that borrows people's data. We could invent a value exchange that is enough to make the consumer come up with to give over their data. You know, there are loads of them already. You know, just the ability to log Facebook, the ability to log in to other websites really easily. Right, it's a great value exchange. So as long as there's a value exchange there, people will give up. It doesn't mean that everyone will. You know, 10% might not. 10% is a very big number, and they will be very, very noisy, and it will give the impression that no one is giving up the data. But still, 90% of everyone, you know, opting in for these things will be significant.
I think it ties back into what we said earlier on about abundance as well. That given the choice in human history, we've generally always adopted the technology that has led us to abundance. We adopted planes, we adopted mobile phones, we adopted social media. And of course, there were people who didn't. There were people who still, some people don't like to fly. Some people will only have a landline. But the norm has always evolved with the majority who choose abundance rather than reject it. And the next big implication of this, that once we have a sentient internet, the next big implication, assuming that's, because that's obviously the done deal, and it doesn't kill us all, then we get a sentient internet, then we can connect to it. And so the next step is about how we have brain out, so how we connect to the internet in terms of how the internet can read what our brains are thinking or what those neurons are firing, then also internet in. And so we get to a point where actually not only can we connect to this central internet, but we can use its processing power.
That's right. We're sort of far reaching here when we start.
Are we?
Because you know we know that there, you know, there's large investment about putting, you know, making the internet information sentient. So you know, you've got Google buying DeepMind, obviously Ray Kurzweil involved. So we know that's happening. We know we're on the journey for that now. The question is, how will we hook ourselves up to it? Now, there isn't any kind of huge investment in that I'm aware of in this area. Like, you know, massive scale investment, but there are lots of companies that are pioneering bits of research in this area. So we can only speculate that this will happen. But Ray Kurzweil says that he thinks that we will, as computers shrink in size, we have nanobot computers which are already existing. You know, they're already tiny little computers are being injected into a bloodstream to do certain functions, medical functions. So they will enter our bloodstream. They'll enter our brains. This is what he thinks, that we'll have, you know, 100 billion neurons will have tiny little computers in them, and they'll connect to the internet via a sort of a 2029 version of Wi-Fi, and will allow us to have access to internet information. And now, how that works is beyond what we know, but you can try and guess it. You can imagine walking down the street, seeing a building, and the language of the brain is called mentalese. So the impulse of seeing that building and wanting to know the name of it is recognised in its kind of like its computational structure. It's passed into internet, and internet draws in information, converts it to mentalese, and then delivers it to you. So you can see a building, you can go, I wonder what that is, and also you know what that building is, and you know when it was built, and you just know it. You have that information available. So the question is, if you could have that information, would you have it or not? Now, a large amount of people would feel uncomfortable about that, but that's our generation. Don't forget the next generation coming through, it'll feel normal to them. And you know, that you think about that and how that would change the world. Think about what that means for advertising.
Well, I think what could be interesting in there as well is a question, I think, that whether it would make us echons rather than humans. So whether it actually will allow us to think so precisely that we will only make conscious choices, and all the behavior economics behind us actually is kind of lost in the data.
Yeah. So all the sort of the
so we won't have biases. We will always make conscious choices.
Yeah.
I don't know what implications are, but
well, you think about the possibility of brands. You can imagine a brand saying, right, well, if people have access to this information, it's free, and we know that people always choose free with ads as opposed to paying for stuff. We know that, right? So you can have access to this internet information available to you whenever you have an impulse, but whenever you decide you have an impulse to buy a soft drink, the brand that tends to be more top of mind is the brand that is bidding to be more top of mind for that impulse. So, I mean, it's a horrific thought, isn't it?
But it's
logically linked from what we know now. So it's not outside the realms of possibility or, it feels like it could happen, and it would be, it's as hard for us to get our minds around as it would be someone in the 1950s trying to understand what someone speaking into Siri on an iPhone 5 is doing, and trying to understand that the whole world's information is in this small box.
Yeah.
It's just beyond their comprehension, because they'd have to understand the internet, they'd have to understand the computers first, then the internet, then they'd have to understand, you know, artificial tech, that it'd be so much. So I think it has to really burn our brains to be a realistic prediction. There's this great quote that we're so guilty of overestimating the present, the future, for years, and significantly underestimating the long future. So, you know, I think it's, for me, I think it will be in our lifetime. I think this will be what happened.
I think you raised a really interesting point around the behavioural economics thing. So how much would that level of information kind of bias our biases? So
or would it eliminate bias?
Well, that's the thing, the inherent humanness that we have. And I started thinking about that. Actually, one thing we're pretty good at as a species is kind of filtering information. So I'd be really interested to see what kind of filters we'd start to apply in that space, because inherently we are still fundamentally governed by a couple of deep-seated responses and biases.
Yeah, but
I think that they would probably still manifest.
Got to, haven't they?
Because you just...
No, I totally
otherwise
get it,
just imagine,
but
like,
just
lines
scary
of people.
Thoughts that basically, if this whole... So basically, saliency becomes an auction. Because...
Now we're using our terminology, in our language probably won't exist, so it's not about saliency, it's a new, different kind of paradigm.
Then putting it into context, then just imagine you're opening the fridge and you actually want a Pepsi, but you ignite those neurons and suddenly Coke is actually auctioning for your neurons and that thinking, and instead of the Pepsi you're taking the Coke.
But it's,
but that's behaviour, that's not, so that's what I mean, that's why saliency becomes, because that's actually action almost then, because you're blurring the lines between kind of response and branding mechanics, which then gets very, very tenuous and complicated.
Well, especially also when you think about the usage experience. So why is it that they would stop at the impulse to choose a particular brand? Why wouldn't they enhance the experience of taking a brand? So why would they not make it so Coke or Pepsi taste better? Because they can control that as well. So that's you know, how far down the rabbit hole do you want to go is the question, isn't it? On this stuff.
Literally the Matrix.
It is.
We're going to be living in the Matrix.
We will be. It's an interesting thing, though, isn't it, that the fear of computers, but actually we end up just ingesting them into ourselves, incorporating into ourselves and letting them change us, as opposed to them being an external kind of threat.
That's an interesting point, the external, because I think people are very comfortable with Siri now and seeing computers as an entity, and there is that kind of other train of thought where, instead of, as you said, us ingesting computers and being part and parcel of them, they do create something different that sits alongside us.
Yeah,
is another way of thinking about how they might evolve.
But I do generally think the direction of travel will be for people to lean into this. Once you've lived with Siri, and especially once you've lived with Google now for a while, you get to the point where you resent it when it's not there, when it's not predicting, when it's not helping you, when it's not clearing a path. And saying, you need to leave by now. Don't forget to do that. Don't worry, your plane's running 10 minutes late. Once you lose that, you feel an absence of that assistance. And having that on the inside, having that as part of the inside track of you, would be, once you've lived with that capability, once you've lived with that technology, I'm convinced it'll be absorbed.
Well, that's interesting, because I think that's something we haven't really touched on, is the fact that, you know, we've so far we've been talking around the area of internet connected, sentient internet connected to our brains responding to impulses, as opposed to it being a proactive force and managing our lives for us, which is kind of what
the Wall-E
now
thing.
Is. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's where you sort of, you know, you have the impulse to go to London, and it says, right, I'll organise it for you, and it says, these are the best flights because I know you like to travel at this time, and this hotel I've got for you, and this person I've set this diary, and also I've got your tickets for, blah, 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 all okay with that? And it knows you want to do those things, and then you then say, yeah, it's great, and all of a sudden you have a drink in a bar with someone, you say, oh, actually, let's change that, and you say, oh, look, and it knows to change it for you, including, and it has API links into all of the different external environments like hotels and restaurants and people's diaries, and it changes it all for you. Think about us getting used to that. Imagine how it will be coming off that will be as difficult as coming down from having been out of space and having to do with gravity again. It will be so hard.
It's like losing a phone now. If you lose your phone now, then it's like you stand still and panic for a bit, and then what on earth am I going to do? It would be exactly the same. You'd be disconnected, and all of a sudden all that automatic, implicit organization that happens around you would just be gone. It would be like losing a limb or losing a phone. And the other thing that it does is that you touch on in the article is that, again, we focus very much on the practical and pragmatic angle of this, but what humans have, because the brains that we already have, we have an aesthetic, and we see, when we see molecules and atoms in the world, we see beyond just what those are forming physical. We see patterns, we see beauty. And we haven't yet begun to explore what kind of aesthetic, what kind of beauty we could see with an exponential amount of brain processing power.
So just for the people listening to this and aren't in the room now, just to let you know, we are now smoking drugs. so be prepared. So, yeah, there is this sort of thought that... you know, the difference between a human and a dog is cataloged in many different ways, but one of them is how many neurons you have. You know, we have 100 billion neurons, a dog will have a lot less than that. And the more neurons you have, I mean, ultimately they are pattern recognizers, these things. So the more pattern recognizers you have, the more you can see order in randomness. So, for example, a dog walks around a landscape garden, sees disorder, or places just to do a poo. We see the symmetry, and we see the beauty, and we see the mind of the person who created it. Now, it doesn't stop there, because we've got 100 billion neurons, we see order in it. What happens if we have 200 billion neurons or 300 billion neurons? What would we see? So the randomness and disorder of the lives around us and around you today, every day, just random, right? But are they random, or is it just that we can't see the order because we don't have enough pattern recognizers? What happens if we have 300 billion, 400? What if we have a trillion neurons? Now, the idea that Kurzweil's floated is that we will simply rent additional neurons that will exist in the cloud. So
from Google Drive.
So, you know, we will just have untold amounts of, you know, you think about kids can kind of, you know, just build new memories really quickly. We can't, because we've run out of cognitive real estate. So if we can basically just keep building, every time you walk, if what would happen, you'd rent, say, another, you know, trillion neurons, cost you, £9.99 a month through, you know, Telstra, and every single thing you see, you tend to remember. And after about 3 years or 5 years, you're starting to see, get more clarity on randomness, and you're starting to have, perhaps at that point, you get a viewpoint of the world that, you know, the great sages have achieved, you know? Perhaps that's what happens. You know, you see synchronicities and you see things that are remarkable. I don't know, but that might be ultimately the big thing here. It might not be about having internet information available to you on impulse or having an artificial agent operating your holidays for you. It might simply be this. This might be the big game in town that we're not even seeing.
And a game which is immediately and synchronously played by 8 billion minds, and 8 billion engines, basically understanding the universe all instantly at one go.
That's right.
And I suppose that the assumption of all of this is that this is where we get linear change. So this whole conversation has been on the assumption that the change that we see over the next 40 years or into the far future will be linear. There's another school of thought, and it's the school of thought that Kurzweil subscribes to, which is the change is actually exponential. And in that instance, we're not far from the hockey stick, right?
So he says that he believes it's exponential, not linear. So that if you look at exponential curve, it kind of hockey sticks up. And he said that we are currently at the knee of the curve, which means we're about to go vertical. And he thinks by 2039, if you look at the laws of accelerating return, by 2039 it goes vertical. And he actually, and a few other people as well, like Dan Manders, and there's a few other writers there, that they don't know what will happen at that point, or everything kind of breaks down. But it could be at that point there, it could be that we generally see the manifestation of abundance, and you could find, because if your brain is connected to more neurons in the cloud, and your consciousness can sit outside of your three-dimensional restraint, then it could be that you experience a reality that is outside of our three dimensions, and it's multidimensional, with all information available to you at any given time and all connection. So like a complete oneness. Now that might be what singularity is, and it's consciousness transcends all the physical boundaries. And from that point, looking back to now, which would be sort of 20, 30 years, 35 years, we won't believe how much life has changed, but that's probably what it takes to do justice to what singularity is and what an exponential curve is when it hockey sticks.
And you've spent more time than most people thinking about this area and exploring it. What is it that excites you about, or what is it that drives your interest and the excitement that you have from exploring this far future that lies ahead of us?
I think just personally, I've always been interested in, you know, consciousness, what it is, experience of it, you know, interested in physics. So I've always been interested in this stuff. And for me, I think it's just a natural draw. I think that whenever you engage people in this, you can probably separate the room into those that just feel uncomfortable and awkward and just think you should stop thinking so much, and those that become completely fascinated. And I don't think there's much space between those two groups. So I just think it's the most important thing to think about, because I think it's the most interesting thing on the table right now for us. And I think our business has a place there, bizarrely, because I think ultimately we are at the forefront now of thinking about how technology is changing how people engage with each other in the world. So we sort of we don't have a place to lead it, of course not, but we have a place to be part of it and to know about it, because it's important for how we engage with people.
And certainly everything that PhD does and everything we stand for, whether it's the thought leadership, whether it's the books we write, or whether it's the entire technology platforms that we've built in the form of Source, which we're at the very early days of starting to even use. We've built that technology, and who's to say what in the future we'll be able to data mine and get from that. Everything we do as an organisation is driven, not wholly, but certainly in part by this, right?
Completely. I mean, you know, the people are not motivated by money alone and by, you know, just stopping clients from being unhappy. You know, keeping it, we're motivated by a higher pursuit, an intellectual pursuit, and that's what nourishes us. So that's the thing about working at PhDs. It's important that people are part of and are in an environment where they are pushed to think beyond where they currently are, and I think it's really important. And you get people actually having much fresher, more future tethered paradigm, which means they're much more likely to be inventive for clients.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's a really interesting territory, and I guess the other side of that coin is around, this is, as I said before, looking at technology in isolation. The other part of what we do is understanding people, so we can't kind of ignore the societal implications of something like this. So I was just trying to fathom what that could mean in terms of, like, giving control. The first person that gets all that power has all that control automatically, so there's massive implications about how society evolves as well. So the other implication around that is how people, and as Christian was talking about behavioural economics, how inherently we will change as a culture and as a society based on technology. So that's an also important part to factor into it.
Which is about all we've got time for in this speech cast. In this speech cast.
Fish cast. Fish
cast. I've tended to watch him more. In this PhD cast. A very big thank you to regulars Stu, Christian and Jess.
Thank you.
And a huge thank you to Mark Holden. Thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
Fantastic.
Being in touch. We'll put this onto the internet and make it just a little bit smarter for this conversation being there.
Can you usually talk about Game of Thrones and... basically, actually.
Yeah, we basically still have privacy, Game of Thrones,
Pokemon Hunting,
and
yeah.
That was it. Thanks very much again. We'll be back next week with a PhD guest.
To get more from PhD Australia, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or find us on Google Plus @PhD Australia.